Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 21st of September. Many thanks to John Munson for filling in for me the last couple days while I went to Brooklyn, New York for a family wedding and had a wonderful time. And I'm sure that you had wonderful shows with John, who's darn good at what he does. This hour, our guest has written extensively in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and many British publications about facts and data. He says we live in an age of data, not facts, and he will explain what that means. And campaigns are being conducted without adequate regard to facts. Facts never seem to cut through. He writes extensively about the Brexit vote and the Donald Trump campaign and says that experts and agencies involved in producing facts have multiplied and many are now for hire. If you really want to find an expert willing to endorse a fact and have sufficient money or political clout behind you, you probably can. So that's what we talk about this hour of the program. And our guest is a political economy professor at Goldsmiths College, University of London. William Davies is with us. He is author of The Happiness Industry, How the Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor William Davies. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we are also on Twitter, and you can find us there at K Dunn Show. Professor Davies, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
So what is a fact? I mean, we have these PolitiFacts here in the States, as you know, and you probably have something similar in England where people are checking to see if statements are true or false. What does it mean for something to be a fact? And then the second part of the question is, it doesn't seem to matter what's fact.
I think a fact, historically, is a type of knowledge that doesn't need to be verified each time it's passed around because it comes from some kind of source which is deemed to be credible in and of itself. So I think the iconic type of fact would be statistics generated by a national statistics office. So when in my country we have an Office of National Statistics, when they declare that the UK economy has grown by 0.5% whatever from one year to the next, that is a fact that then can travel around the media, within amongst scholars, amongst the public, and people don't constantly have to kind of ask themselves, is this true or is this not true? And so part of the quality of facts is the capacity to nurture public debate, but without having to be constantly scrutinized for their veracity. And I think that the concern at the moment in the context of events such as Brexit in my own country and the rise of Donald Trump's campaign in the United States is that people are abusing particularly statistics, but are also looking at types of facts and statistics which ordinarily have been viewed as credible and beginning to say, well, actually, I don't necessarily agree with this one. I don't know if I like the source of this particular data on, say, immigration or the economy. So I think that there's a kind of facts have become politicized in a way, and it's creating quite a bit of chaos in the nature of our public debate. Mm.
And we also seem to be moving into a time where not only are we not looking at facts, we're also starting to believe in conspiracies.
Yes, well, I think these things go together, where if you have a modern public sphere where it's no longer accepted that, for instance, take the example of immigration. Britain is not a country that has a particularly high level of conspiracy theories, but one of the most popular conspiracy theories in this country is that the government is lying to us about the number of immigrants coming into the country. The majority of people believe this to be the case. And so this is a case where the government publishes some figures, and it will show that the number of immigrants coming in is very high. It has been very high in recent years. But people will say, well, that fact has been distorted for political purposes. So as facts start to disintegrate in terms of their role in public life, that I think does go together with the rise of conspiracy theories, because people start to adopt the forms of knowledge that they find comforting or which make them feel secure, or which provide them with a sense of identity, rather than with those which have been verified by the traditional sources.
Mm-hmm. As you write in one of the many pieces that you've written recently, you can take a certain set of facts or data, maybe is the right word here, and if you pay somebody enough, you can use that data to suit your own political end, can't you?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, it's worth being clear about exactly what I've argued here. I'm not suggesting that management consultants or accountants or economists are literally for sale in the sense that you can pay them enough money and they'll say whatever you want. It's not quite that clear cut. But I think that what has happened over quite a long period of time, I think over the 20th century, accelerating in the late 20th century, is that there's developed an industry for quantitative analysis, for statistical analysis, where, you know, say you were a company that wanted the government to privatize a particular industry, or say you were a company that depended on certain types of public service outsourcing or something like that, you would go to, and I'm not going to name names because it makes it sound like I'm accusing certain companies of not being honorable, but you would go to a big consultancy firm and you would say, you know, I want you to do an evaluation of this market and to find out whether or not the current situation is efficient, or whether it would be better improved if we were involved in it and so on. And it's kind of clear that, you know, the numbers are no longer somehow from sort of outside of the economy. They don't just descend on us from economists in ivory towers or from statistics agencies with no vested interest. There are lots of businesses out there that exist in order to provide clients with economic and statistical analysis. And I think this was clear in the run-up to the financial crisis of 2008, that the credit rating agencies in that instance were, their clients were the investment banks that were producing the credit derivatives that ended up blowing up the world economy. And these credit rating agencies were effectively taking money from companies in order to say that their products were safe when their products were not safe. So I think that the relationship between the market and facts has got a lot more muddy over recent decades.
Mm-hmm. You've been following the Brexit referendum closely too. Let me ask you this. For the Brexit referendum, you wrote in one of your pieces, the Leave argued that the European Union membership cost Britain £350 million a week, and then failed to account for the money received in return, which really was not factually correct. You later wrote, if the British government had spent more time trying to track public sentiment toward the European Union and less time repeating the facts, because they gave different sets of facts of how the British economy benefited from its membership in the Union, it might have fought the Brexit referendum campaign differently and more successfully. So I guess the question is, if we're living in a time of data and not facts, in that campaign, how would it have been fought more successfully?
Well, I think I'm not saying that I have the answer to how you would have won that referendum. But what I do think is the case is that there are certain arguments which are best left alone altogether. And I think that it turns out that a lot of people in this country, and obviously a majority of people, voted to leave the European Union, as soon as they hear politicians telling them that they're better off in this situation, for instance, they're better off having more immigration into this country, or they're better off being governed in certain ways by Brussels or whatever it might be, not only do people not believe it, but it actually makes them quite hostile to that argument. No, I'm not saying this. I don't know exactly what the answer is. One of the problems with that £350 million a week claim was that the truth, so I don't know exactly what the truth might count as, but say it's sort of, it's still in the, you know, over £100 million a week once it's all told. The government didn't want to have to even get into that argument because whatever it was, it sounded like a very large number. So they decided to just leave the whole thing alone. So they ended up allowing one particular statistic to circulate that was, broadly speaking, not true. They then threw back a load of statistics they believed were true regarding the benefits to the UK GDP, the benefits to you know the risks to house prices or the risks to jobs and so on. What they were never able to do, and I don't quite know what the answer would have looked like, but was to make an argument that was rooted in people's day-to-day experiences. They constantly, but this is partly because this is how they'd won, how the Conservative Party had won the 2015 general election, was to just simply keep repeating the same arguments about macroeconomics. But actually, okay, they won that argument, that election narrowly. But macroeconomics, not only does it not seem to correspond to people's day-to-day experiences, it can actually make them quite angry when they hear people treating arguments about the economy as a whole as somehow kind of more important than their own personal experiences. Now, actually, I'm not suggesting that you can win everything just by running focus groups and that kind of thing. And I don't know if there was an answer when it came to Brexit. It may be that there wasn't. But I think that over time in Britain, we have developed greater and greater separation between a certain culture of expert politics in London and these what seem culturally very, very distant areas of the country in the northeast, in South Wales, and in parts of the Midlands and elsewhere. And these were the areas where basically the argument was just completely lost when it came to the European Union.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the States, where a lot of arguments seem to be lost by Donald Trump supporters as well. It's really interesting what's going on here, and I think that there may be, tell me if you would agree, some similarity in terms of culturally marginalized people. So there are a good chunk of people who never, you know, lost coal jobs or lost manufacturing jobs, huge numbers of people in this country, and they've never recovered from them, and the government has been unable to provide some different kind of income for them. So there's a cultural marginalization. There is more immigration. There are will be a majority minority country by, 2050, I think, is what people say is the time. So this idea of, you know, take back control, make America great again, that no matter what a candidate may say, no matter what, I mean, it's there's been a major, as you know, Washington Post expose over the last few days where the money from a Trump foundation has been used to buy 6-foot pictures of Donald Trump, and people gave money to a foundation. I don't think they gave it to get a 6-foot tall picture of Donald Trump. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they thought that was okay. Yeah. But the whole thing is, how does all of that tie into what you write about? Is it that this idea of incredible marginalization, so it doesn't really make any difference what you're saying? It doesn't have to be factual at all.
Well, I think, I mean, the historical context of this is that so we're talking partly about geography here. So the equivalent in Britain would be parts of the northwest, South Wales, the northeast, which were the places which were at the center of global capitalism, really, at a certain point in the 19th century. And equally in the United States, you know, looking at bits of the Midwest and elsewhere, subsequently became absolutely pivotal to global capitalism, and have quite rapidly become very peripheral. And I think that the way in which politicians have dealt with those parts of their nations over the last 40 years and so on is to somehow not to accept that they're second best, but to argue that unless you can look after the interests of the centers of the economy, which in the United States is obviously the northeast, Southern California, and so on, that you can't get any wealth anywhere else. So there hasn't actually been, I don't think these areas have really been seen as anything other than places to somehow sort of cope with, possibly to spread some money around using tax dollars to some extent. But they haven't actually been spoken to directly in and of themselves until this surge of populism that you've seen. Of course, the Republican Party sort of managed to combine the interests of big business with the interests of or the cultural interests of these parts of the world using religious and conservative tropes in quite a clever way for a good 30 years or so on. But I mean, even that was a short-term fix to some extent. In Britain, again, there was certain ways of combining the cultural and the economic arguments that were pitched to these parts of the country. But ultimately, I mean, when it comes to something like Brexit, I think that there was a a kind of heady rush of what democracy might actually mean, which suddenly hit people on the, you know, in the run-up to June the 23rd, where for the first time in many people's lives, a lot of people voted for the first time ever with Brexit. A lot of people had just never believed that democracy offered them anything whatsoever, and Brexit was the first time they'd ever stepped foot in a polling booth. And I think that it's a different idea of what it means to participate in elections, because it's actually an outlet for a form of anger, for a form of despair in many ways. And I think that the unfortunate thing with the United States is you couldn't hope for a worse candidate to oppose Donald Trump, given the nature of the appeal of Donald Trump. I mean, it's difficult to be in American public life for 25 years like Hillary Clinton has and not have a huge amount of animosity directed at you, whoever you are. So I think that, I mean, you couldn't hope in as much as the emotions that people are feeling are emotions directed against Washington, against mm-hmm. elite, against the same old, same old. Even if she was the perfect combination of Barack Obama and JFK and Roosevelt or whatever, she still would have a huge problem on her hands, because the anger is against a system that has let people down. And I think that the same problem struck Britain with Brexit. I mean, there simply was no one on the Remain side of the argument who didn't just look like another London politician. In desperation, they managed to get David Beckham to say something at the very last minute. Right. But I think by that point, it was too late. You know, so I mean, I think that these movements are not founded on a credible vision of the future. So when Donald Trump says incredible things that he does day in, day out, they don't harm him because people have given up on credible visions of the future. And it may be, again, with that £350 million a week, why don't we give it to our NHS instead? That argument that people didn't care about the credibility of it. They were sick of the sort of what seemed to be a sort of doubtful authenticity of people like Tony Blair, and this sort of desperate attempt to be sincere that politicians have sort of tried to parade so much over the last sort of 20, 30 years. So that someone who doesn't really care whether they're credible or not, I think, has quite an appeal in that type of climate.
Mm-hmm. And if you were gauging the level of despair in the United States, would you say that it's comparable to an underestimated, certainly, level of despair in Britain that resulted in this Leave the European Union vote? Is it a similar kind of despair large in this country, do you think?
I think that, I mean, this is in some ways a question for social scientists to. You know, there would be answers in terms of exactly the levels of deprivation and so on. I think that there are certain things in common. I mean, one thing which one study that I have seen so far, which was a look at the shared values of Trump supporters and Brexit supporters, which the area where there are shared values is in a commitment to what is called authoritarian values. And this means people who believe that that there has been a loss of authority in society, that criminals are not being punished properly, and in this you might include bankers and whoever else. Well, you know, this idea that Hillary Clinton is a criminal, these sorts of claims that circulate. Some of the policy views that are associated with authoritarianism are that that sex offenders should be publicly flogged, that it's almost like a kind of a pre-modern ideal of what's lacking in society, which I suppose in some ways the Republican Party has accessed via aspects of its evangelical base or the Tea Party and so on. In Britain, I think that this cultural sense that modern life in general has let people down haven't really been ever harnessed by any political party, really. It's never really been spoken to. And its main object of fury has been immigration. And this has been, I think, recognized for a good 20, 30 years, immigration to Britain has risen quite sharply since the early 90s and rose very sharply in the mid-2000s as a result of the enlargement of the European Union, which was something that Tony Blair thought was an unambiguously good thing, and a lot of people in this country didn't. So I think in Britain, people have been playing with fire, and not really paid attention. I think anyone who's paid any attention in America probably has seen that conservatism and the Republican Party have been dabbling in more and more and more dangerous types of politics, and that the kind of idea of the coalition that, say, George W. Bush won his elections on was a potentially quite explosive one. And I think, you know, this is now being demonstrated. But exactly how the levels of deprivation compare, I think, is a kind of question for economists and statisticians.
We're going to welcome phone calls, and our guest this hour is political economy professor William Davies. He's a sociologist, co-director of the Political Economy Research Center at Goldsmiths College, University of London, author of The Happiness Industry, How the Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. He's written a couple of pieces in American publications, the New York Times and Washington Post, that caught our attention, The Age of Post-Truth Politics, and he has written extensively about Brexit in the Post. Brexit will make things worse. Is that why people voted for it? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We have lines open for you right now, and we'll go to you momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. We're talking about the age of post-truth politics, and we have yet to go into, and we will in a moment, a deeper conversation of people who have utterly given up on the future, and that is true not only in Britain but also in the United States. This idea, which has been written about before, but certain voters casting ballots directly against their economic self-interest, how does that happen? And what would have to happen to change that, if we know the answer to that? Let's start our calls with Jeff in Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Kathleen. As always, this is a great show, but I'm not sure this time around it's so much an issue of people ignoring the facts, which are clearly staring us all right in the face. I think we've always done that. I mean, look at Bush and WMD in Iraq and President Nixon's pre-election plan to get us out of Vietnam. Facts have always been a bit mushy. In fact, I looked it up. Einstein himself famously said, quote, "If the facts don't fit the theory, change the facts," which surprised me. But what seems different to me this time around is that people are neglecting the very values that have supposedly meant something in our history, that have supposedly been, I hope, at the foundation of facts, such as inclusiveness and truthfulness, et cetera. But anyway, it's a wonderful show, and I look forward to hearing the rest of it.
Thanks, Jeff. Professor Davies?
Yes, that's interesting. I mean, I suppose that part of the appeal of facts is philosophically, in the way that I'm describing facts or defining facts, is that they are kind of immune to values. So, well, these are the facts, regardless of your value. It's been how, certainly in my country, under Tony Blair, in the late 90s and early 2000s, it was incredibly effective. The way of governing the country was to go and find out whether or not a certain policy worked by simply going and collecting a load of facts. And then if it worked, you do it again. And if it doesn't, you change it. I mean, it's sort of a very sort of technocratic idea of how politics should work, and that it was sort of immune to values. Now, I'm not quite sure I understand how the caller understands. You know, we may be using these terms slightly differently. But I think that in some ways there's something quite alienating about facts viewed in that way, because it sort of seems that, in a way, the risk with that is, and this I think is in some ways a bigger risk in the United States than it is in my country, but I think that there's a risk of using facts in that way, that you're kind of treating people like they're stupid, and people don't, you know, people react understandably badly towards that. And I think that, you know, our sort of, like a lot of public discourse has broken down, partly because I suppose in the past we had, you know, we had ideologies of certain kinds to guide us, and I think that you know, you can't rely too much on facts. I think one of the arguments that I've made is that in some ways, I mean, every time there's a leader debate in an election or something, in a way they end up just hurling facts at each other as if this is kind of going to settle the argument. But ultimately, you can't somehow try and duck broader political issues and treat them purely as matters of science and expertise and facts and figures. So I think that in some ways, one of the things I've argued in the articles that Kathleen's alluded to is that we've let facts sort of become sort of too powerful in some ways, and we need to get back to trying to understand each other in ways that don't simply come down to statistical representation.
Hmm. Should we spend a few moments, Professor Davies, talking about, and you've written about this, how we are receiving our information? You write about populist movements and then combine that with social media, often held responsible for post-truth politics. You write, individuals have growing opportunities to shape their media consumption around their own opinions and prejudices, and populist leaders are ready to encourage them.
Yes, I mean, this has been a recognized as a danger, I think, since the mass media started becoming digitized most rapidly in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s. There was a book by the legal scholar Cass Sunstein called Me Republic, published, I think, in the early 2000s, which was about the risk of once you've got more bandwidth than you need and you've got more producers of content than anyone needs, then people can just pick their own news, their own entertainment, their own content in the same way that they can select their groceries. And that this means that there's a kind of breakdown in a sense of a shared public sphere that used to be a kind of forced upon us by the fact that there could only be so many, you know, print newspapers and so many like broadcasters and so on. So I think that this has been a growing problem. I think that it's exacerbated by social media, which really has taken off in the last decade. Facebook obviously has huge power in amongst all of this, not only in relation to the advertising market, but also in just kind of deciding how many contradictory views we ever even encounter. I mean, if Facebook decides that we might be happier and better off or more keen on Facebook if we only ever discover things that we already agree with, then they can sort of make that happen. And I think that's certainly a risk for the nature of public debate. And I think that in some ways this is a kind of quite a dangerous cocktail of social media plus this new type of populism. I think, we have also it's not just on the right. I mean, on the left, we have a new leader of the Labour Party, who became leader of the Labour Party last year, Jeremy Corbyn, who is much further to the left than previous leaders. Some people have compared him to Bernie Sanders. And I think one of the things that is interesting about Corbyn and his movement is that it's no longer clear what political success means for the supporters of Jeremy Corbyn, because in the past, it would always be, well, you've got to win a general election. That means you've got to get, sort of 12, 13, 14, 15 million people to vote for you, or however many it is to actually become the prime minister. Whereas now, it's not clear that that's the main criterion of success, because a lot of the time, people seem to take great excitement from the fact that Corbyn can bring 5,000 people into a city centre to come and listen to him, or that a certain video might have 2 million downloads on YouTube. Or so there are all these different kind of indicators of what success means that have sort of thrown the question of where politics happens into a certain amount of confusion. And some of Corbyn's supporters have said, well, why do you think politics is just about winning elections? Which of course, it's not just about winning elections. They're absolutely right. But at the same time, that means that Britain will be almost certain to have a conservative government for the foreseeable future, because you have an opposition party that is no longer playing the game of trying to win back power in quite the same way.
Let's go to Kit next in Mount Horeb. Hi, Kit.
Hi, Kathleen. You had a guest on a couple of years ago named Charles Eisenstein, who wrote a book called Sacred Economics. And I was very moved by that book. And to me, it seems that what's going on today is there's an enormous disillusionment with a very large lie, which is that capitalism is somehow a great system, and that there's so much that when we think of capitalism is based on interest debt, which requires constant growth, and one way that we have constant growth is through commoditizing more and more of what used to be our culture, so that we our culture is disappearing for only one thing, a race for money. And I think this disillusionment among people like in the Tea Party and people who are voting for Trump is a very deep and serious bad feeling that they're, that we don't. You had another guest on who made the comment that PTSD, when people came back from Iraq, was not about the pain and suffering they saw in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It was about living in a very tight-knit unit where the people trusted each other, and then they came back to a country where the only thing that mattered was getting an iWatch or a new snowmobile and being part of a consumer culture that had no consideration for family, community, and all the rest.
Professor Davies.
Well, I think I would agree with the caller. I think, and I think this has been something that no politician has really been prepared to speak about. Other than maybe the new figures of the left, such as Sanders and Corbyn. I think that there's been either an assumption that very rapid, sometimes quite devastating global capitalism is either just completely kind of unavoidable, which effectively was the position of the Labour government under Tony Blair in this country, or there's straight out lies that have been told by the Republican Party in the United States, which is that we care about family and faith and community, while at the same time doing absolutely the opposite of what will actually support those things. So I don't think there's been anyone really at the center of public life in either Britain or the United States. There may be some in Europe to some extent, where you have more of a social democratic tradition in mainland Europe, but who has actually come out and said what the caller just said. And I think that we had there's a movement in Britain called Blue Labour, which is an attempt to try and marry aspects of the left or the Labour Party to conservative values of localism and community and the sorts of things that the caller was just referring to, and saying that actually this should be now what the Labour Party in Britain should be about, is actually becoming a party that is against big business and against big government, and it's about local community and so on. But I think that I don't know if many people know quite where to start in trying to what do you do about the power of Wall Street? I mean, it's not a power that can be very easily disentangled. In a way, there's a very, very slow and very, very long-term project that needs to be initiated or accelerated, which is towards different institutions of credit and different institutions of property rights and of shared property and different ways of caring for the elderly and for children in ways that don't simply heap more and more and more stress on people who are already vulnerable and in need, because I mean that's basically how where our model of capitalism has got us to, in my view, is to punish people who are already weak and to tell them that because they have needs, it's up to them to work even harder to overcome them or to serve them themselves. And I think that this is not a socially sustainable model.
Mm-hmm. And those people who have those needs, and those needs are being fulfilled by some government programs, you have more than we have, certainly in healthcare.
Yeah.
The people are filled with a kind of self-loathing, would you say, because they have to be the recipient of those programs?
Well, I think there's certainly been a problem, which is there's a culture which was specifically deliberately manufactured and encouraged under Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher, of treating people who are dependent in certain ways as morally weak, as people who were guilty of being scroungers, of being people who weren't trying, of people who were somehow sort of had character flaws, which meant that they went around looking for someone to somehow scrounge some money off. And we all are born into the world in the state of complete need and complete dependency. So it cannot be an accurate description of the human condition, that the dependency and need are somehow sort of shameful or unworthy states of being. But I think that it's true to say, I know my own country better, but I think when you look at some of the areas which voted for Brexit in a very, very pronounced way in the northeast and in South Wales, you've never really had anything that has come in and given economically since the decline of steel production in South Wales and of and in the northeast and shipbuilding in the northeast. There hasn't really been anything that's come in and given people a sense that they are kind of earning their own way in the world. Either the government shifted certain back office public sector jobs in those directions as a way of trying to push some jobs away from London and to try and keep some level of prosperity in those areas, or you had rising levels of welfare, which actually we didn't even use the word welfare that much in this country until recently, but it's become a sort of dirty word in the way that it became in the United States as well. And of course, this day in, day out, you've got large populations being encouraged to see themselves as somehow less worthy because their communities, their families, their whole regions are not actually able to pay their way in the world. You know, you have areas where no one's had a job for three generations in a single family since the decline of mining or whatever industry it might be. And I think that these are this has very short term emotional effects, but I think it has long term cultural effects that we need to also connect to movements such as Trump's and the Brexit movement.
Kit, thanks for your call. We go to Dan in Stevens Point. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Thank you so much for having this topic. I'd like your guest to comment on the application of the concept of post-truth politics to climate change. As he knows, I'm sure, for the last 25 years, we in the United States have been the recipients of a disinformation campaign that has been purchased for millions, maybe even billions of dollars to convince Americans that climate change is not happening and that all climate scientists worldwide are in a giant conspiracy and that what's really going on has nothing to do with our use of fossil fuels, for example, and that instead what's going on is climate scientists are doing it in order to get money, when actually the fossil fuel industry is using it to get money. The goal has been doubt, to sow doubt in the American public, and it has been a very successful disinformation campaign, and a great many politicians have been happy to jump on that bandwagon. So I would like to get his reaction to that.
Okay.
Yes, I mean, this is obviously a very important example, and in some ways it's one of the archetypal cases of truth just being systematically dismantled around certain economic interests. You know, I said earlier in the show that I didn't want to imply that experts were absolutely up for sale in the marketplace, but of course there are cases where with enough lobbying clout and enough money, you can buy a certain type of scientific representation of the world. So another example would be the tobacco industry and lung cancer, or there are plenty of other examples. And also the way, I think, you know, the way Wall Street banks lobbied so hard after the financial crisis to try and kind of cast different sort of views of the situation that which didn't make them to blame. So yes, I mean, this is obviously the way the caller puts it is absolutely right. Is to make out that there is a lot of doubt. To make out that this is a matter of political perspective. That in some ways we still don't really know anything here. But I think that one thing which I think is definitely problematic about climate change, which we shouldn't forget, is that it is also a hugely complex and constantly changing issue. It's not quite like something like, you know, cigarettes and lung cancer, where effectively there's a fairly sort of stable body of evidence over several decades that X has a certain chance of leading to Y, and that chance is dangerously high. I think the problem with climate change is it's what some theorists would call a wicked problem, where it's sort of constantly changing. It's difficult to say exactly what the nature of the problem is. We're kind of living it in real time. We are discovering the problem at the same time as and a lot of the time the problem is actually turned out to be a lot worse than we thought it was. I mean, a lot of the in terms of the melting of Arctic ice and so on, a lot of it seems to be moving much more rapidly than scientists expected. But nevertheless, it's one of the types of problems that it's difficult to get a completely clear fix on. And it's not that I think it's doubted in the way that maybe the oil lobby would like to throw doubt on it. But it's a very tricky problem because it's so vast, because it's complex, and because we're moving through it in real time, and it's not something we can sort of run a laboratory experiment on or something like that. But obviously it's a classic case of post-truth politics, and I think it's also an important reminder that because it's been going on for some time now, as have other examples like tobacco and cancer, but that this we didn't suddenly throw facts out the window when Donald Trump or Brexit came along, that clearly this type of attack on scientific authority has quite a longer history, and I think particularly in the United States.
We're talking this hour about the age of post-truth politics, and our guest joins us by telephone from London. He is political economy professor William Davies. He's a sociologist, co-director of the Political Economy Research Center at Goldsmiths College, University of London. He is also the author of The Happiness Industry, How the Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. More phone calls momentarily at 800-486-8655. On the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And let's go next to Pam in Madison. Hello, Pam.
Hi. I think we haven't gotten to the part of the book about well-being yet, but there may be a connection in some of my work where what I've learned is, liberalism is more...
I'm sorry, Pam. We're not hearing you very well. Have you got your phone?
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
Neoliberalism has been much more the culprit than capitalism because neoliberalism.
All right. Well, we'll just have to leave it there because then capitalism, then I can't hear you anymore. But that's enough to go on, Professor Davies.
That's like a great question. I love
yes.
my neoliberalism.
Is neoliberalism to blame?
Is neoliberalism to blame? Well, I think interesting. I mean, neoliberalism, I wrote a book called The Limits of Neoliberalism, which came out a couple of years ago,
which
highlights the fact that if there's a defining feature of neoliberalism, it's not necessarily about markets or banks or anything like that. It's about the idea that all of human social life should be run as a competition, and that that when people get rich, they should be commended because they've won it in a competition, or whatever it might be in the education system. We need to rank all the universities constantly, otherwise we'll never know which is the best. And so there's a sort of a mindset that everything is about a ranking, a competition, an identifying of the best. But I think that this in particular, capitalism doesn't have to work like that. I mean, Keynesianism didn't work quite like that. There are other ways of running university systems, there are other ways of running healthcare systems, and they are compatible with capitalism. Capitalism doesn't need to turn everything into a sort of version of entrepreneurship, which is what neoliberalism does. But I think the problem with neoliberalism in particular is that by its own logic, it consigns most people to the status of losers, because in the obsession with discovering the number one, with the best, with the winner, with the most competitive, you end up with a system that is great at, or you could argue it's not always that great, but it's good at identifying these very, very self-confident, world-changing individuals such as Steve Jobs or whoever it might be. But what does it offer anybody else other than a sense of envy or aspiration?
Mm-hmm.
And you can only sustain aspiration for so long before you have to wake up and realize that actually it's not going to happen. You're not going to be Steve Jobs. You're not going to be, Michael Jordan or whatever it might be. So a society that is premised on the majority of people looking enviously on a very, very small minority, I think has inbuilt social destruction, self-destruct mechanism on a social level.
And what about a society, and there are many in both our societies right now, who have utterly given up on the future, as you write about. How do political movements gather those people's votes, and how do you even run for any kind of office if you're talking to a large number of people who hold no promise for the future at all? Is there an obligation to lay out a plan for the future?
Well, I think the problem is people have listened to plans many times, and they don't feel that things have changed. And it is also the case. I mean, they're not entirely wrong, these people. I mean, wages in the United States have basically flatlined since the early 1970s for most people in real terms. And, certain things have got cheaper thanks to globalization and so on, but real wages have not risen for most people for over a generation. This would explain, I guess, why someone like Bernie Sanders I've never known a left-wing figure like Bernie Sanders succeed like that in the United States, and equally Jeremy Corbyn in Britain. So in a way, there's something, people say that it's not realistic to support Corbyn or Sanders or whatever, but in some ways it's the only realistic thing, because they're the only people who are actually speaking honestly about the nature of the economic change, of the nature of suffering today, the nature of privilege and power today. So in some ways they're more realistic, but I think that the problem is that people like George W. Bush or Tony Blair, to some extent, were quite good at triggering certain populist, hitting certain popular buttons, saying the right things, acting the right way, but after a while, people feel duped over and over again, and they don't actually they don't trust politicians making promises. So in that sense, I think for Trump to say we're going to build a wall, or we're going to drop a bomb here, or we're going to do this at airports and so on, or I'm going to get rid of all of these people immediately, the lack of realism about it is in some ways, I think, an appealing feature because it shows a complete disregard for the usual political lies. I mean, those claims aren't, because they're not really in the sort of arena of truth in the first place, you can barely call them lies, because they're more like sort of symbolic gestures. Whereas if someone says, and I'm going to bring all these jobs to the economy, and it turns out that they don't, or I'm going to bring a job to you and they don't, then I think that is much more disappointing. So I suppose that, I don't know what to say to a mainstream politician wanting to speak to these kind of people, because the problem is that what they want is a source of identity. They want to be spoken to in a way that they're sick of receiving promises. They're sick of receiving plans and statements about the future that somehow don't materialize. So they'd rather just dwell in the present. I think that Brexit was in some ways people wanting to go out one day, June the 23rd, and do something that made them feel good. And that was putting an X in a box saying, leave the European Union. And a lot of them, I don't think a lot of people really thought about what that meant. I don't think they expected the Brexit campaign to win. A lot of them probably still don't believe that Britain will leave the European Union, because after all, it hasn't happened yet.
Right.
And so there's a sort of just completely dwelling in the space of the present, because the future has just become too much of a burden to think about any longer, and that includes things like climate change, as your caller was talking about earlier.
Yeah, there are a lot of big issues, that's for sure. So how are they feeling about Brexit now? Is there still a widespread belief that Britain will not leave the EU?
The new Prime Minister, Theresa May, has made it very clear that Britain will leave the European Union. What has become, what is going to slow it right down is that no one really knows how to do it. It's very, very complicated.
Mm-hmm.
If your government and your economy and your nation becomes entangled with those of others over the course of 40-odd years, then disentangling it requires forms of expertise that basically don't exist. And we don't have anyone to negotiate trade deals, and we don't know how to regulate our markets. We don't know how to do all of the different types of policy that were dealt with in Brussels. So I think that the slowness of it will eventually cause a serious backlash, because we haven't even begun to exit, and then once you begin to exit, it'll take another 2 years from there. So it could be that there's, if the economy starts doing badly, there could be some serious popular reaction, I think.
Thank you ever so much for being with us. We covered a lot of territory. Thank you.
We did, yeah.
Yeah, we did. Thanks.
Okay, thanks very much.
Yeah, thank you. Our guest, political economy professor William Davies, joining us from London. He's a sociologist. He's co-director of the Political Economy Research Center at Goldsmiths College, University of London. And he's author of The Happiness Industry, How the Government and Big Business Sold Us Well-Being. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing the hour, Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios. Hour number two, we'll be talking about African-American male teachers. Do young black students, male students need them?